It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Well, today it's a new way to buy wine, a clue to check for on the label. Know your importer and you could shortcut choosing your favorite bottle. At least that's true of importers like our guest, Neil Rosenthal. His wines are about his taste. It just so happens his taste is nearly legendary. Well, it's cremated herring for the Sterns. Our man of the golden palate, David Rosengarten, brings order and tranquility to that baffling potable, sake. John Willoughby of Gourmet Magazine has inspirations for Between Meals in London, the cooking schools, the shops, and a secret garden. For gardening at home, New York Times gardener Ann Raver talks seed sources. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today it's the rare breed of the wine business, the importer who selects his wines the way a curator hangs art, with expertise and assured taste. Neil Rosenthal of Mad Rose Group Imports is one of the great contrarians of the wine trade. He talks terroir and what to look for on that label. Well, our tasting guy, David Rosengarten, has a refreshingly simple guide to buying and serving a most confusing liquid, sake. Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby talks what to do in London between meals. New York Times gardening columnist Anne Raver has the best of the best seed sources. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Hey, you two, have you gotten back to one of my favorite states to eat in, North Carolina?
Yes, and in fact, we made a point of going to North Carolina sometime between January and April. We went to eastern North Carolina to the shores of the Roanoke River because only during those months and only along the shores of the Roanoke can you eat actual river herring, a longtime specialty of the state that is really rare nowadays.
What, now, wait a minute. I didn't even realize herring was possible there.
Well, you know, to me, herring has always meant little cubes of fish in a jar with some sort of marinade for an hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah, and they made in the factory. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, factory made. Herring is actually a fish, we learned, and it actually runs in the Roanoke River. And there have been for years these places called herring shacks along the shores of the river. A couple of them remain. And they serve herring the way they love it down there, which is basically the whole fish. And you have a choice when you order herring at the Cypress Grill in Jamesville, North Carolina, of whether you want your herring very well done, which they call cremated, or very lightly done, which they call sunny side up. And it's a huge difference. It's almost like two different types of food.
So is this, what is it, fried, grilled? How do they do this?
It is deep fried. It is scored almost down to the bone and then lightly breaded and then thrown in the deep fryer so that if you get it cremated, the fish is cooked to the point so that you can eat virtually everything but the backbone. Sunny side up is a very fishy piece of fish. You have to love fish to enjoy a sunny side up river herring.
But, you know, even if you're like me who despises fish, as I think our listeners know, the Cypress Grill and the places that serve this herring are so incredibly wonderful that you will fall in love with being there. They're truly little old shacks that are over the river and totally, you know, frilless and as bare-boned as a cremated herring, but charming in the way that so much of America is kind of losing, you know, with the developments. But this is, you know, back to the past.
And I must say that a fish frowner such as Jane had plenty to be thankful for when we went there, because Leslie Gardner and his wife, who run the place, make some terrific real down south type pies. We had a chocolate pie there that was still warm because we got there early for dinner. They had made it earlier in the day. It was a warm chocolate pie that was so fudgy and so good that you could make a meal of that if you have a real sweet tooth.
No, if the herring, though, run only a short time, essentially, are they open year-round? I mean, or
no.
The business is just open up for the herring?
The Cypress Grill is open from January through April, and that's it. Traditionally, the people who ran herring shacks were tobacco farmers, because the rest of the year they can farm their tobacco, and in the 3 or 4 months at the beginning of the year, they ran a herring shack. I'm not sure that Leslie Gardner still does the tobacco part of the equation.
So, okay, got to be there from January to April. Guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Well, stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
The Stearns are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And speaking of finds, how about finding out exactly how three of Italy's world-class foods are made firsthand? How about tasting them at their sources? How about talking with the master artisans who are still making them by hand? Now, I am talking NPR's April trip to Italy. It's going to take you to the home of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, Parma ham, and the true balsamic vinegar. You know, the stuff that's aged for decades and you sip it like a liqueur. Well, all three come from one region, the one that the Italians call the culinary capital of Italy. It's Emilia-Romagna, and it's where I spent 10 very happy years researching. Now, we're going to meet up a couple of times to compare notes, and then you're going to be off to the homeland of my family, Tuscany, and you're going to see why Francis Mays is still reveling under that Tuscan sun. This Italy trip is happening in April, and there are just a few spaces left, so you can find details on our Italian adventure on the website, splendidtable.org. David Rosengarten has done it all, well, nearly all. He co-authored a groundbreaking book on pairing wine with food. He was a pioneer on the Food Network. He does the Rosengarten Report newsletter, and he's written award-winning cookbooks. Now, the latest is David Rosengarten Entertains, fabulous parties for food lovers. Hey, David, it's good to have you back.
Lynn, it's always great to talk to you.
Well, David, now, in the book, you have got this Japanese party starring a grand sake tasting.
Now, yes.
I want to focus on the sake because, as far as I'm concerned, sake is the most confusing liquid you can find in a glass.
Makes my head spin without the alcohol even.
Yeah, and you've studied it, right?
I've tried.
Can you first of all explain exactly what sake is?
Yeah, so people often call it fermented rice wine, but there's even confusion about that because people who know sake say the process is really more like the beer making process. It is basically rice that has been had some of its outside sort of polished away, as they say.
Uh-huh.
And then it gets mixed with water and a kind of yeast, and it brews and it becomes alcoholic. That's basically what it is. Sounds simple, yes, but you're so right, Lynn. It is when you start looking at those labels and you try to understand, as a wine lover would understand wine, you start getting into the categories and all that, it is just endless and so complicated. It has freaked me out for years. So a year or two ago, I decided to really get down on this subject and really try to understand it and present it as a party in this book so that you can teach, you know, five of your friends and have this great sake tasting along with dinner.
Okay, so tell me about the kinds of sake. How does this work?
Well, it's best to think about these kind of hierarchies. And the problem is that a lot of these categories sort of cross over. But let me try to make this as simple as possible.
Okay.
Most of the sake that they drink in Japan is a category that's called futsushu. Futsushu.
Mm-hmm.
Starts with an F. Just remember that. Futsushu.
Okay.
And it's kind of like cheap stuff. In fact, they add a lot of alcohol to it to sort of bring it up to strength. And it's not very good tasting, and it's not very easy to find in the U.S. either because the sake drinkers in the U.S. are mostly connoisseurs. We don't sit around watching the football game drinking sake, you know, but they would watch the wrestling match in Japan drinking sake. So we don't see much of that. You
okay.
Go up one level, you get to several categories of sake where they have very meticulously polished the outside of the rice away to get more towards the kernel of the rice. The more you get to the kernel of the rice,
mm-hmm.
the more you get a big fruity flavor in the sake. So it's considered desirable to have more and more polished away.
Okay.
Now, the big category that you really need to know about is a category called junmai. This is a category that has had the outside of the rice polished away.
Right.
And by law, they cannot add any alcohol to it. So it's very natural, and it gives you that fruitiness from the kernel. So look for junmai on the label. Now, you can go up a couple of categories from junmai.
Okay.
You can go to, for example, junmai ginjo, which is the category that has even more of the outside polished away. And then you can go to Junmai Daiginjo, which is actually my favorite category, which has a lot of the outside of the rice polished away, and it gives you a very fruity, delicate, and complex kind of sake. So that would be a name for you to remember.
Okay,
Junmai Daiginjo.
So if I say Junmai on the label, and right. I see a long word after it.
Right. Well, of course, one of the problems is that sometimes these words appear in the label in Japanese.
Oh, boy.
But the best importers are putting in English these words on the back of the label. So you want to look for those words, Junmai Daiginjo.
Now, you do not serve it warm. Am I correct about that?
Well, in Japan, there have been both traditions for centuries, warm and cold.
Mm-hmm.
They say that the warm is usually what's done for to the low-quality stuff, because the heating covers up the flaws in the sake.
Okay.
Certainly in modern Japan, without doubt, and there are many sake, you know your typical wine geek,
yeah,
who runs around and he knows all the fermentation temperatures and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There are many sake freaks like that in Japan. They would never be caught dead drinking a sake warm. It's cold sake all the way with the modern generation of sake connoisseur.
And what kind of container? I mean, a glass? Can you do it in a wine glass?
Yes, you can. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what I recommend in the book. There are many traditional sake cups, and one of the most traditional are little square wooden blocks that you drink out of, which I think are quite exciting, but they're not really great tasting cups. It's difficult to take, you know, the little sip that you need to take. So my recommendation in the book is to give each one of your guests 8 white wine glasses, and then I lead you through the tasting, and I tell you what 8 sakes to gather for your sake tasting party.
Well, David, thank you.
It's a tough one, Lynn.
Yeah, it is, but I know more now than I knew before. Hey, thanks a lot.
You're so welcome.
Food Authority David Rosengarten's newsletter is the Rosengarten Report. Now, David's latest book with that sake tasting in it is David Rosengarten Entertains. Now, you can find David's recipe for salted seaweed salad with lemon and freshly grated ginger on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, while you're checking out the site, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week we send you a new recipe for a quick supper dish, and we also send along shopping and technique tips. But best of all, it's free. So you can register for it online, you know, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the new way to read a wine label and London's cooking schools. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. Okay, you've figured out that the wine with the pretty label didn't necessarily deliver the great taste. But there is something on that label that could be a big clue to knowing what's inside the bottle. Check the name of the importer. Now, we hear a lot about winemakers and wine tasters, but the people who actually pick the bottles that end up on the shelves don't get much attention. Neil Rosenthal is a wine importer and a curator of sorts. He's been described in worshipful tones as being, and this is a quote,
a rebel against current wine culture. He heads up the Mad Rose Group Import Company. Neil, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. My pleasure to be here.
And Neil, you're an importer, so essentially the wines that you bring in are about your taste.
Yes, you are buying into a process that, it defines my taste, absolutely.
So if I see your name on a bottle, and I kind of like that first bottle I buy, as I buy more bottles with your name on it, I'm probably going to find that I enjoy those as well.
I think we would end up sharing a sense of taste, absolutely. I think you will find that my wines search for one most important thing, that is the expression of pure terroir. We can talk about that a little bit later, about the real definition of that term.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, stylistically, I'm looking for wines that express their origin very clearly. Some of them can be big and full-bodied. Some of them can be lighter styled. It's not a question of weight or power. But it is a question I'm looking constantly for, the greatest and purest expression of the fruit and the climate of the area in which I'm working.
Now, you mentioned terroir, and we're hearing this word constantly. Why is this so important, and what does it really mean?
Well, terroir for me is a word that is frequently abused, but for me it's quite simple. It is a sense of place. One is looking for a wine that expresses, that tells you clearly when you open that bottle and taste the wine, where it comes from. It is a sense of origin. It's much that people have a certain sense of personal terroir, if you will. And I think each wine, what I am looking for is a wine that expresses its roots. And that has to come from a certain coming together of the soil, the climate, and of course the human hand.
Now, one of my understandings of terroir is that it's about wines made in the old ways, in the traditional ways, because now there's a much more modern way of making wine.
I don't think terroir and modernism necessarily have to clash. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. Each wine has its own terroir. You may or may not like it. That being said, I do think that certain modern vinification techniques sometimes can overwhelm that sense of terroir. And that's where I think we come into conflict.
Now, is the conflict this idea that wines today seem to be big and fruity and very easy to drink young, in so many words, very approachable for most of us?
I think there's a tendency to ask for that. I think this has been a long-term evolution of wine. I think a lot of wines right now are very fruit-driven, very forward, very sort of maybe a little bit too easy, a little bit too facile. I like a wine that you have to struggle with occasionally. Not to say that it should be an unpleasant experience, Lynn, but I think that sometimes some wines take a little bit of time. It's a little bit like people. It's always wonderful to have your children around you, but as they grow older, they're a lot more interesting to talk to.
But, you know, I'm thinking of the other part of this from the winemaker's point of view and from the people who sell the wine. If you have to age a wine for it to come into its own, that's a major investment.
Yes, I think this is another one of the obstacles in the pure enjoyment of wine. We are bound into a circumstance where the economics of holding on to wine are very daunting right now. And that's an unfortunate circumstance. When I first started in this business 28 years ago, one would show up at a grower's door and there were three or four different vintages available to choose from. Nowadays, if you're not online instantaneously after the grapes have been harvested, you're out of luck. And I do think there is this whole process of speeding up our life experience, and it is unfortunate. We have to fight against that. Part of my work as an importer is that I do buy my wines at the estates with which I work, and I try and store certain of them and release them later on so that people can understand the intense sense of gratification one gets from drinking a wine that's been aged properly.
You know, describing you, Neil, as a curator isn't too far from the mark. I mean, you really are framing these wines, collecting these wines. Are there other importers that you would like us to try that you have a high regard for?
Yes, I think there are several colleagues of mine with whom we certainly are in direct competition, but I have a good deal of respect for several people. There is I hate to say there's a certain generational divide. When I grew up in this business 25, 26, 27 years ago, there was literally a handful of people doing the kind of work that I do. And I still look to them as reference points. I think my colleagues, Robert Chatterton, Kermit Lynch, and I, as a certain trio, we share a certain similar approach to our work. I find that there certainly must be some in the younger generation that are as assiduous in their selection process as we have been, I think, but I'm a little bit more mystified by the way they go about doing their business. It may have been a little bit easier for us in those days when there was nobody tramping around in the vineyards with us, and now there's a bit of a mob scene out there, and so I think it's a little bit more difficult to find one's identity.
You know, one thing, does terroir cost me more money?
No, absolutely not. In fact, what you're paying for is what's in the bottle. We don't have to pay for advertising. You don't have to pay for brand names. What you do have to do is to be an active and eager participant. This is not a passive effort, and the consumer should be looking to partner up with a fine retailer who is doing an editing job and is looking for interesting, provocative, and pure and classic wines. And that is a collaborative process, and it's very, very important.
Very interesting take. The importer is the curator, and the retailer is the editor. Neil, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Neil Rosenthal heads the Mad Rose Import Group. Now, for information on where to find his wines, go to our website, splendidtable.org. And you can also see Neil in the documentary film Mondo Vino. Okay, you got a steal price on a ticket to London. Well, now you have got to pick up a copy of the March 2005 Gourmet magazine. It's all London, all the time. Everything you need to know from the locals. Now, to give you a leg up, we have Gourmet Magazine's executive editor, John Willoughby, with us. John, good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn. It's great to be back.
Well, John, I know this covers London restaurants, you know, 16 ways from Tuesday, but I want to talk about what to do between meals.
Ah, that's good. There's a lot to do between meals.
Well, that's the thing I love about the list, that you talk about shops and all this other stuff, but there's one thing. I'm a sucker for history, and for all the times I've been in London, I have never been to the Chelsea Physics Garden or Physic Garden, and you got there. You've got to tell me about it.
I did. This is a great treat. It's one of those quirky little things that you find in a big city like London that you just sort of happen upon, and they're great. It's actually a huge garden. Well, not huge. It's a couple of acres, though, and it has all kinds of herbs and all kinds of plants, things you would never expect to find in London because it has a microclimate that's much warmer than the rest of the city. So, for example, they have the biggest olive tree in England is there. They have pineapple trees. They have an aromatherapy border where they have all these amazingly aromatic plants. And they have a huge herb garden. It was started back in 1673 as a way of training apothecaries about how to use various herbs and plants. And it's been going on ever since then. It's just this little oasis of beauty and restfulness right by the river in Chelsea.
You know, for herbalists, this has got to be heaven.
It is.
One of the big questions we hear a lot is, where should I go or can I get a cooking class when I'm in a city? And I know London has got some great schools, but what are your picks?
Well, there are actually three that we really thought were great. The first one is called the Billingsgate Seafood Training School, which is a lot more fun than it sounds like. It takes place at the Billingsgate Fish Market, right there at the market, and you basically learn an awful lot about fish, you know, what varieties to use for what, and you get to see a cooking demonstration, and then you get to eat the food, so it's also great. Another one I really like was called Leith School of Food and Wine. And this is a pretty old, it's a 30-year-old school, and they have very hands-on workshops. Saturday mornings you can go and learn how to put together a dinner party, or you can go on weekdays, and they have workshops like bread, chocolate, Thai cooking for beginners. Mm-hmm. It's really a very high-level cooking school. But the one that might be my absolute favorite is at a store called Books for Cooks. And this started out, they started testing the recipes from cookbooks there in this little tiny kitchen they have. And then they decided they would set up a few tables and let people come and have lunch there and eat the recipes they were tasting. And then people started asking for cooking classes. So now they have a little upstairs place where you can go and have these great cooking classes. You can learn about Japanese food or Moorish food or regional Italian cuisine. It's very varied. They have a lot of experts come there. It's really a great place to go and learn to cook. It's a lot of fun.
What a civilized way to run a bookstore.
Isn't it? Only the English.
I love it. What about kitchen shops and tabletop shops?
There are, of course, I mean, London's a huge city. There are a lot of tabletop and kitchen shops. A few of them, and some of them are sort of generic that you might find in other places around the world, but there are some that are very unique. A couple that I really like is one that's called Mint, and it's in this area called Marylebone Village, which has several blocks of basically cooking shops and restaurants. Mm-hmm. And this is all unique artist-inspired dinnerware and tabletop stuff. So you go there, you'll get something that no one else is going to have, and it's really sort of almost like art. Another one is called the Metal Gallery, and this is in Mayfair. And again, it's inspired by artists. This is all metalware. You can get very unique, sort of surprising. For example, you can get salt and pepper shakers that are just hilarious and beautiful. These, again, are things that you won't find anywhere else.
Markets. That's the other thing. Great food markets. I mean, like outdoor markets and things like that.
Well, the absolute best market in London, and I think one of the best markets in the world, is called Borough Market. On Fridays and Saturdays, it becomes this open-air market where people come from all over Britain, basically, with the best cheeses and produce and meats and breads, and it's totally just packed full of people shopping, and there are a lot of little restaurants where you can stop and get a snack to eat. During the week, it's a food wholesaler's emporium, but during these Fridays and Saturdays, it is a wonderful outdoor market.
Sounds great. Hey, John, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. Now, Gourmet Magazine's London issue is March 2005. You can find some of John's picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Love to dig the dirt. The time is nigh. Now, I am talking to you gardeners and you wannabes. I don't care if your North 40 is your windowsill. If you're going to do any mail order seeds, now is the time. Now, to help with choices, we have one of the Pied Pipers of horticulture, New York Times gardening columnist Ann Raver. Ann, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be back.
So, Ann, what new stuff are you putting in this year?
Well, my friend and I, who garden together, are interested in all these different colored carrots that people may be reading about. And there are purple carrots, and there are bright orange carrots, and there are pale yellow carrots. And I think it segs right into this obsession with our health. And, you know, if you grow organic food, so you can become a healthy, pure person as you're tasting this wonderful food. And these seed catalogs actually talk about, they break down the colors. I thought this was great. The orange ones are rich in beta carotene. The red ones contain lycopene. Yellow, high in xanthophylls. Purple carrots, rich in anthocyanins. Or is it cyanins? Anyway, all of these protect us against heart disease and cancer and all that jazz. So,
and they look great on the plate, right?
Yeah. And if can you grow them? That's the other question, because I've always found carrots hard to grow in our Maryland clay soil. So, but if you have plenty of sandy soil and raised beds, you probably would do fine. So that's one thing.
How about greens? Greens are easy to grow, right?
Well, greens are fabulously easy to grow, and they're so productive. And even a very small 3-foot by 3-foot garden or a whiskey barrel on a terrace could grow arugula, and there's a wild arugula now that's really delicious that's on the market. There's Osaka mustard, all the purple mustards that are coming from the Japanese markets. There's a wonderful kale called Red Russian that's very tender. It's kind of a gray-green leaf with purple veins. Mm. You just can really have fun designing your own salads. There are chicories, and some of the catalogs are really testing these individual varieties. They go to France and Italy, and they really test them for cooking. So I have favorite catalogs that I really trust.
Is that the standard that you set for choosing sources for your seeds, mail order sources, that you know that they've tested out those seeds themselves?
Well, oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think it's always the family-run companies that sometimes they're so successful, they're sold to bigger companies like Burpee or Parks. And not that they are necessarily bad, but but the individuals are apt to be more experimental. A good example is Renee Shepherd, whose original company was Shepherd Seeds. And I mean, that's still a fine seed source, but Renee's experimental seed company is called Renee's Seeds. And she's constantly traveling, and then she tries these varieties. So when she says something's good, you know she's grown it and cooked with it.
Do you have another one for us?
Well, another real favorite of mine as far as the cook's garden is called Sheeper's Garden Seeds. And the bulb lovers know Sheeper's as a really wonderfully reliable bulb company. The father, I think, is Dutch. But the daughter now has started a vegetable offshoot of that, and there are fabulous recipes. I mean, you get these catalogs now, and they're like cookbooks. So, you know, you might not be thinking of leeks, but you read this recipe, and you know, by golly, you've ordered their special leek. So that's another great one. And so is Johnny's Selected Seeds. I'd say those three are my absolute favorite. Johnny's, they're not so much into the cooking, but they are a fabulous company from Maine, and they really test everything.
This is great. Ann Raver, thank you.
Thank you.
Ann Raver writes the garden column for the New York Times. She's a dirt gardener at her family's farm in Maryland. Now, you can find Ann's seed sources on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question comes from Gourmet Magazine's London issue. Here it is. What began on Pudding Lane and ended at Pie Corner? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. It came from the Gourmet Magazine's London issue. Now, the question was, what began on Pudding Lane and ended at Pie Corner? Well, it was the famous Fire of London. On Sunday, September 2nd, in 1666, a spark from a bake shop on Pudding Lane started it all. The fire blazed for 5 days until it ended at Pie Corner. Nearly the entire city was in ashes. 100,000 people were homeless, and the mobs took over. Blame was thrown at foreigners, at Catholics. There were lynchings. Yet the longest-lived story of the fire involves food again. It comes from the diary of a busybody Londoner named Samuel Pepys. He wrote down every tedious move that he made during his life as a royal court groupie. Now, his diary reports that he takes credit for warning the king of the fire, like the folks at the palace hadn't noticed. Then he ran home to save his wine and Parmesan cheese from becoming fondue. He buried them in his garden. As I recall, he makes no mention of his wife, of his help, of his house. Just his cheese and wine. What a guy. The lines are officially open, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Olivia calling from Oklahoma City. Hey, Olivia, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, my question concerns pecans.
Yeah.
More specifically, I have a large, very bountiful pecan tree in my yard, and I've just had loads of pecans this year. But I really have trouble cracking pecans.
It takes
a long time, and it makes a mess. And I'm trying to think of an easier way to deal with that.
Let me ask you something. Are you taking them right off the tree and then trying to crack them?
No, they're falling on the ground, and I pick them up after that, and right now they've just been waiting. You know.
Because one of the things that I understand you have to do with pecans, and I just remember this because a long time ago a friend of mine was living in the South and had her own pecan tree, mm-hmm. and one of the things was drying them because they're a very, very moist nut.
Hmm. Okay.
So she would pick them, and then she'd kind of put them on a screen or put them in an airy place and forget about them for about a week. But it had to be a dry place, not in the sun, for instance, but someplace that was dry and airy. And then what she did was she put them in the microwave with a bit of water. And then she'd use a hammer, but she'd tap them so they just barely shattered, the shell barely shattered. But she did. It was something like not a lot of water with the pecans, and they were in a bowl. And she'd microwave them, this is memory, 5 minutes at high maybe. Let them cool, let them sit for a few minutes. Never leave them in water. Never leave any nut in water for any length of time. It'll rot. Yeah, but she'd pull them out then, and then she'd just spread out a whole bunch of newspapers, and we'd sit there with hammers going thunka, 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 thunka. And you'd, and yes, some of the nut meats got damaged, but most of them we managed to get out without a big problem.
Well, interesting.
Yeah, because it's a royal pain to do it.
Yes.
I mean, only butternuts, I think, are worse.
And my idea was that maybe there's a way you could boil them, because I've thought of boiling peanuts.
Yeah, but peanut shell is a very different animal than a pecan shell. Boiling them, you're never going to soften that shell quite enough without turning the nut meat into something you really don't want to eat.
I see.
Yeah, but try this. Try the microwave.
Well, good deal.
Hey.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Your help.
Take
All
care.
Right. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye. You can reach us, guys, 800-537-5252. You know, the nuts protect themselves, and sometimes they do such a good job, we can't get to eating them. Okay, who's up next? Let's see. We have Amanda calling from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Amanda, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. I have a question about garlic presses.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Well, I pretty much always chop my garlic, but I know people who sort of swear by their garlic press, and some recipes specify using a garlic press. So I'm just kind of wondering what the pros and cons are to press or not, I guess.
Well, okay, you're asking a good person on this because I'm with you. I'm a masher and a chopper. And I believe anybody who writes a recipe that says use a garlic press has always used a garlic press and has never been in our world. That's basically
what
it comes.
They just don't know what they're missing.
They don't know what they're missing. Now, here's the difference really, though. A garlic press tends to release more of all those juices and stuff in the garlic. You tend to get a little bit more pungency, and you don't get as much of the fiber of the garlic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of the places I'm using garlic, I could care less. The difference between my putting a clove of garlic on my counter, near the edge of the counter, putting it on a little pile of the salt that's going to go in the dish, taking the side of the blade of a good-sized knife and then laying it over it, and then with my palm just going whap, you know, is that the way you do it?
That's the way I do it. It's very satisfying.
Very satisfying. Boy, do you vent. You can't vent with a garlic press. And then, you know, then you mince it or not. I think I extract as much stuff from it, and I think it just tastes fabulous. I think this is a case of pure preference.
All right.
Yeah, and those other folks out there will no doubt continue to use their presses, and we too, smart as we are going to do what we're going to do.
Exactly. Thanks, Lynn.
Hey, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. And by the way, please don't tell me how much you love your garlic press. We know, all right? 800-537-5252. We have Jonathan on the line from East Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Jonathan, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. This is so exciting. My wife and I absolutely love your show. We listen every week.
I'm so flattered.
well, listen, I love to cook. This is my gift to my family. It gets a little embarrassing sometimes because I send my son to daycare, and I've got to send him with his lunch bag, and all his food has to be labeled and dated. So all the other kids are bringing things labeled peanut butter and jelly. My son brings things labeled ragu bolognese or a flank steak with gorgonzola butter. It's unbelievable.
But with a soupçon of saffron. I'm sorry. Yeah, right.
So this problem occurs elsewhere in my life. I married into a Southern family, and they cook very simply, Southern cooking. Lots
right.
of vegetables, greens, pinto beans, you know, with fat back, that whole thing. And my coriander-crusted salmon doesn't really work with that crowd. So one thing I'm really interested in learning to cook is a real good pulled pork barbecue.
Ooh. Oh, but I think, where in the South are you again?
Well, I live in Michigan.
Yeah, that's right.
But my family lives in North Carolina.
All right. Okay. Because you realize, fighting words, when you say pulled pork,
it
is so, I mean, this is like Italy. I mean, this is just like Italy with
right.
Southerners. You say pulled pork to someone, let's say in Memphis, and you serve them a pulled pork in the style of Eastern North Carolina, and they'll walk out of the room.
Right.
And of course, you know, who are you calling? You're calling a Yankee, originally from the New York area, right, living in Minnesota. And you, God bless you, you are such a believer. You think I'm going to have an answer for this. This
right,
is fabulous.
And I'm a Yankee myself, having grown up in Connecticut, so.
Okay, here's the thing now, and I'm going to send you to some references.
Okay.
All right, here's my sense, all right? They're from North Carolina?
Yes.
Are they from the mountains, or are they from the flatlands?
The Triad area, Greensboro.
Which
is closer to the mountains.
Closer to the mountains,
yep.
Okay. Now, this is what I learned when I was in North Carolina all three times.
Okay.
Okay, I mean, briefly. So expertise here is limited.
All right.
The kind of sauce that is used there, and it is put on the pork after the cooking,
right.
is a vinegar sauce. It's usually vinegar, black pepper, hot pepper. No tomato would ever go near it. If there's sugar in it, there is such a small amount you would never know it was there.
Right.
And mustard. And then the pork is usually the pork shoulder. Now, here's where I'm foggy. Like a Boston butt. You've got it. You want a lot of marbling and all that great fat. And the idea is that you rub it, and this is where I get foggy.
Okay.
But I'm going to give you some references in a little while anyway.
Okay.
But salt, pepper, maybe garlic powder.
Okay.
And maybe paprika. And then you do a slow, slow roast. Indirect heat. Either you do it in the barbecue. I know people who actually do it in the oven. You know.
Right.
They never tell anybody.
Sure.
But you want to get this to about 190 degrees internal temperature.
Okay.
And it takes 7 to 8 hours, so it's like 240 degrees you're doing
real
this.
Slow.
Real slow. And then they're jackhammering the building, so you'll just have to ignore this, Jonathan. So, and then the idea is the pulled pork has to go in a hamburger bun. It has to be served with sweet sour coleslaw, not mayonnaise.
Right.
Not mayonnaise. And then the sauce just gets it sort of dribbled on it. And
fabulous.
And the books would be
okay.
Southern Food by John Edgerton, I think is his name.
John Edgerton.
Right. And then there's a fabulous book called Smokehouse Lightning. Lolas Eric Eli, I think was his name. Okay. You know what? I'm going to leave you with those two because
okay.
Edgerton in Southern Food, it's an old book. It's been around for about 20 years. But in Southern Food, he does a whole tour of barbecue.
great.
Okay?
Thank you.
You take care. Bye. Please excuse the noise, guys. We are in the middle of a building project. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see. We have Pavel calling from Fort Collins. Hey, Pavel, what's up?
Well, hi, Lynn. I am a Pepper fan from way back.
Right.
I have noticed there is an amazing spectrum of quality and flavor that you get out there. And I'm just that's just within the black pepper. But well, one of my questions is, I've discovered after taking apart melange and then finally buying bulk green pepper, I really love green peppercorns whole and ground. And I'm just wondering, what has been your experience about applications where green pepper really, really comes out and blooms?
I think the simplest things, because for those who don't know about green peppercorns are essentially unripe peppercorns. And they're often, as you know, Pavel, they're often actually sold pickled, you know, like in vinegar and that kind of thing. But there are also people who are drying them and selling them as peppercorns, if I recall correctly, having worked with them for a while. But where I think anything that has that bright kind of pungency that I think green peppercorns have, it shouldn't be muddled up. For instance, it works well with lemon. You know, it works well with a citrus. So lemon or orange, if you think about it.
Oh, sure.
Because acids and that pungency of a pepper like that really marry beautifully. And imagine that on something like a piece of fish.
Well, I've discovered just with plain old black pepper, two of my favorite applications where it seems to bloom are chicken soup.
Oh, yeah,
either
right.
commercial or homemade.
Right.
So you get down to the bottom, and boy, I love, in fact, that's where I begin to tell the difference between, hey, I've got a great pepper this time, or I've got a mediocre one. And the other thing is corn on the cob seems to really bring out different subtle differences in pepper.
Well, there's another application that I was going to mention.
Yeah.
It's sweets. Because I'm going back now to the days when peppercorns were very, very valuable. And you showed off pepper. And black pepper, especially because you could see it. Now, I'm going back to the 1500s, the 1400s, right?
Right. And back then, it was almost a medium of exchange.
Exactly. Peppercorn rent. I mean, people, if you had a shipload of peppercorns, you could have been Donald Trump. But the thing is that whether it's green peppercorns or it's black peppercorns or even white, you put them on really sweet melon, put them on a piece of fresh orange, put them on something like a peach, and it explodes the flavor. It really does. And, I mean, a melon in the summer, oh, it's wonderful with black pepper on it.
Well, in Mexico, there's a certain couple of spices where they mix things. Just for putting it on melons, I bought something down there one time.
Ah, this is, well, you know, the other thing, you've just reminded me of something. Try making caramel, okay? You know, take sugar, put it in a pan, let it cook slowly until it turns golden.
Okay.
But put into it coarse ground pepper, whether
You're
it's
kidding.
Green
no,
or black.
Really?
Put in a ton of it, and then what you do is let that cool. You can water it down slightly, so it's like a syrup, and drizzle that syrup over a grilled steak.
Oh, my gosh.
That only salt on your steak. Let everything else sit aside. Just drizzle that combination. Put that over duck. Put that over anything that's smoky. Put it over lamb. And then if you put that, just a drizzle of it, over salmon, you will have died and gone to heaven. And
oh,
you can,
I'm making notes.
Yeah, because you're caramelizing the pepper at the same time as you are marrying it with this intense but very brown sugar taste. It is going to sing like a diva.
Thank you so much for these tips.
Thank you, Pavel. Great. You're starting my mind going in a new direction. I love it. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. So maybe you're thinking about starting a little food business. Take that great recipe that your friends love and maybe make some money with it. Well, this is what Rick Field did. He's the pickle guy at New York's Union Square Market. His pickles are called Rick's Picks. He sells them at the market and on the web. Hey, Rick, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Rick, how does somebody become a pickle person? I mean, is this something, was instead of being a fireman, is this what you wanted to do when you were a kid?
Well, you know, it's an interesting progression that I took. I would have to say that it started out really just as a hobby like any other. And I moved from there into a more obsessive phase, and all of a sudden I found myself doing it full time. It was kind of a creeping evolution.
A creeping evolution. I think Darwin would love that. So what kinds of pickles do you do?
Well, right now Rick's Picks has 10 varieties. We have 4 cucumber pickles. We have 2 green beans. We have a pepper. We have a green tomato. We have a red onion. And we're working on an okra.
What are the influences? What is inspiring your pickles these days?
Well, you know, what I've tried to achieve with my pickles is a new set of what I call flavor trajectories. I think I tried to use my interest in food in general and in the way that cuisines and food ideas from various cultures can be blended and melded, and I tried to apply that to pickles.
So, for instance?
Well, my mom taught me how to make a green bean which I call the mean bean, which is a traditional New England dilly bean.
Right.
It's a cayenne brine, fresh flowering dill head, garlic, and it's, you know, widely available. What I found myself doing, though, was Japanese influences, and started to bring soy and wasabi into the brine, still using a white vinegar, and all of a sudden, with some, you know, extra spices added, it's a completely different pickle. And thus we have the Windy City Wasabi and the green bean and the soy wasabi brine, which has become, for us, the top seller. It's interesting, too, what happens in the pickled context. Wasabi, as we all know from our experiences with sushi, has a sort of a chili heat through the nose sensibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the pickled context, it takes on more of a smoky character. So, you know, there's a sort of a huh factor for the consumer. You know, they get a little jolt of something new, and it's a nice departure.
Well, Rick, best of luck with Rick's Picks, and thanks.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Rick Fields is the pickler behind Rick's Picks. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from none other than Galileo. He said, "Wine is sunlight held together by water." Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. You'll also find details on our trip to Italy on that very same site. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.